Are you seeking more creativity in your life? Join us, Nadia and me, Laura, the hosts of the Creative Rumble podcast.
Each week, we delve into the minds of inspirational creatives, share their wisdom and our own creative journeys. We explore how to align yourself, develop creative ideas, and find inspiration.
Join us as we explore what it takes to live a creative life so you too can feel the creative rumble.
Living a creative life is for everyone. Let's Creative Rumble.
The Creative Rumble podcast acknowledges the traditional custodians of this country and recognise Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples' continuing connection to land, sea, waterways, sky and culture. We pay respects to elders, past, present and emerging. And as we come back, this is like a three-part series, you know that. It's like the Paris Hilton series.
Series or the sex tape?
So we've touched on the foundations of your storytelling, of you creating theatre, of you examining, of you sharing, of you embracing it. Mm. Let's talk about those stories that you were telling. What made it different? What made those stories different too? Because, you know, those stories have been written before, performed many times before. How did you try to make them different?
Well, that was really important to me, particularly in an age where there is so much media to consume. There is so much storytelling. I mean, even just someone doing a post on a social media site is a story, and how, or someone will do a tweet and it'll be reshared and commented and then reported on in the media. Like, there is this perpetual storytelling, and but also that story can be retold in sound bites and grabs and accommodating short attention spans, and particularly COVID, we struggle now with shorter attention spans. What fascinated me, I guess, so take Shakespeare, for example, that I'd always been interested in, but I'd never been obsessed with or like actively adored him and he was my favourite playwright. He wasn't at all. I hadn't engaged in him enormously, but I found myself starting to be drawn to his work, and he wasn't the earliest work. Romeo and Juliet was the third piece I directed for Dionysus, and then it was Macbeth. Okay. There was something in between. I literally can't remember. Oh, Lysistrata, and then it was and then it was Macbeth.
I love how I'm like, yes, that's right. I'm like, oh,
So there was also, and I did the so I did a couple of Shakespeare's. I did a couple of ancient Greek pieces. So we are talking classics. We are talking hundreds upon hundreds of years. You know, so it would be understandable and easily argued that this work is no longer relevant for our present day. There is more relevant, more meaningful work. Shakespeare's work was written and performed at a time when women weren't allowed on stage. Like, I love sort of sharing with my students, you know, Romeo and Juliet, the greatest love story ever told. Oh my God, no, it isn't. It's 3 days. They're children and six people die. It's not the greatest love. It's an absolute disaster from start to finish. But they love this idea of this romantic couple. I'm like, well, no, she was sort of 12 to 13 and she was probably played by a young boy. Well, she was played by a young boy. And the kid's like, what? Yeah, he would have been prepubescent. So his voice was high pitched and yeah, women weren't allowed on stage. And it's like, so it's also, you've got to be very open and aware of, you know, the contextual influences within a particular work of art. And that's, I think, where my role as a director and a teacher married quite beautifully is, you know, the subject theatre studies is you work with an existing text, but before you even look at, well, how are you going to interpret it, you've got to study it contextually. Well, what was the historical period when it was written? And then if it's a different historical period, well, what's the historical period in which it's set? And whether the playwright themselves actually owns and explicitly addresses it, what was happening that will have influenced them? What will we see in this work, the ideas, the themes, the conflicts that are our direct response to the surrounding influence? You know, what did society look like? What was the societal structure and the values and the laws? And culturally, what did people believe and how did they live their lives? Because it is not separate. Like, it is embedded in the work and you have to understand that in order to appreciate the work in its entirety, but then be able to go, cool, well, do we want to we want to set in a different time period? Or do we want to change elements? Like, you can't change the work, but what are the core ideas? What are the core values here? And then when you hit on those, okay, well, then that, how do we work that to be truthful to the work but also present the work in our way? And so that married beautifully as a director. That really helped me to go, well, what do I want to do and how do I want to do it? And with Romeo and Juliet, it was really quite, no, know I'm not embarrassed about this, but it was always quite superficial, I guess. So I decided I want to do Romeo and Juliet because I wanted to do Romeo and Juliet because everyone knows Romeo and Juliet. I'm thinking, yeah, that'll be a fun challenge because it is such a told story. Like, well, what am I going to do and how am I going to do it? Anyway, I was, God, what, 19, 20 when Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet came out. So I watched a few. I watched the Zeffirelli. Oh, yeah. I watched a few of the Romeo and Juliets. I watched the Globe production. Amazing. And then I went, you know, Old Faithful, I went to Baz Luhrmann. And I do love it. It's like, oh, my God, it's like an old friend. And then we get to the famous scene, like Juliet's in the church. She's surrounded by the flowers and the singing and the candlelight. And it's all so beautiful. And then Romeo's, you know, shot everyone to get into the church. And, oh, my God, there she's dead. And, of course, Baz Luhrmann, the bastard, like we know in the text that he sees her, he thinks she's dead. He drinks the poison. Spoiler to everyone who had read Romeo and Juliet. He drinks the poison. Actually, that's quite relevant to what I'm about to say. He drinks the poison and he dies and then she wakes up. But Baz Luhrmann has her just starting to wake up and he doesn't see that. And she's just starting to wake up and he's already taken the poison and it's just about to take and she sits up and he sees her. And her face lights up going, oh, you've come to me. And he goes, oh, my God, you're alive. And then he dies. And she's watching him die going, what the hell, what the hell. So it, oh, my God. And even as I talk about it now, I'm like, the tragedy of it, the Romeo and Juliet's all about mist, it almost this, it almost that, it almost that.
Yeah.
And in that moment, and I found myself in that moment. So not only had I seen that film several times before and I knew exactly what was going to happen, even if I hadn't have seen that film, like many people, even if they've never even seen or read or engaged with Romeo and Juliet, they know how it ends. We know the story of Romeo and Juliet. We know it well.
Yeah.
And I was in that moment going, just don't drink the poison just yet. Just wait. She's about to wake up. Like, and I was willing a different outcome, even though I knew that was ridiculous.
Mm.
And I think that just started something in me going, you can be that invested even when you know. And I suddenly thought, you know, like I said before, in today's culture and particularly online, it is absolutely unacceptable to ruin something. Like you will see at the start of post, spoiler alert, do not read further if, and then people will leave all these gaps. So you have to click on see more so that, yes, people can discuss a twist or an ending that they need to dissect or they need support with, but they simultaneously go, do not do this if you've not seen it. We do not want to ruin it for you. This perception that if you already know the event outcome, the experience of the story is now ruined. And look, I'm not diminishing that. That is in many cases, there is something absolutely magical about watching something for the first time and hitting you in that moment. But also, we don't want to diminish that you could know exactly everything that happens in the sequence of events in a story and still be completely in that story and even be deluded and misguided by that story, like this blind hope, because we as humans, we want this, we want that. And I suddenly went, well, what is it about Romeo and Juliet? What is it? Like that's the biggest spoiler alert. You go to that story and you know from the second. Oh, and that's the other thing too. Like even if you went to Romeo and Juliet blind, most people know that they die at the end. It's pretty well known. Often it's like the tragic love story of Romeo and Juliet. Well, there's a clue right there. But I thought even at the time, even when it was first performed in Elizabethan theatres, for those of you who aren't aware, like many of his plays, Shakespeare opens with a prologue. Two households, both alike in dignity, in Fair Verona, where we lay our scene. It's a series of short lines, and at the end they go, yeah, the kids are going to die. Like it tells you in that opening section, and then, okay, now let's start the play.
Yeah.
So you before the there weren't curtains, but before the play officially began, that you know the man would come out and deliver the prologue. He goes, "Oh yeah, by the way, these two families, they hate each other, and you know the only way they make up is because their kids fall in love, and because of the feud, they end up dying." And the family's like, "Oh shit, we better fix it." Like Shakespeare wrote it better than that.
Sure.
But just imagine the iambic back to pentameter, like making that a little bit more classy, but. Yeah, like
how did you do it differently then?
Well, I guess what I did was I wanted to focus on the story, the telling of the story. So, and I think the idea was great. The execution had some kinks to organize, but it did work well. It just needed some tightening. Mm. But for those of you who know, so the play opens because with Shakespeare plays, there's 1,000 characters, which is why you often see a lot of productions. They'll blend characters together. They'll just remove characters, a lot of editing often. Or you'll have an actor who'll play 6 different roles. Like there's a variety of ways that's handled. Anyway, so there's two characters right at the beginning that are only pretty much, I think they're only named in that opening scene, Samson and Gregory. And they are of the house of, I'm literally having a mental blank now, they're the house of Montague, I think. I could be wrong, my apologies, everybody. And they're the, for those of you who are somewhat familiar with the play, that's the, they literally look to start a fight. They see the, let's say they're of the Montague house, I forget, and then they see the Capulets. And they go, oh, let's start a fight. I bite my thumb at you, which is basically like sticking up your thumb. And they start the fight and it all happens. And there was just something about Samson and Gregory. There was just something about who they were and how they played. And by the way, I just remembered they're from the Capulet house, just so we know they are from the Capulet house. Anyway, there was just something about them. And I just spent some time with them and I went, no, that's it. So I thought I created two new characters, like a Sam and Greg, basically. And Sam would be female because I wanted to have, I definitely wanted to sort of restore some gender balance, as it were. So Sam and Greg, who would, before the play even started, they would introduce the world of our play. I hadn't worked out how it was going to happen. They would do the prologue. They would be Samson and Gregory in that scene, but they were through everything. Sometimes they would just be watching, but other times almost every single role that wasn't a very significant ongoing character in the play, they played. Mm. But they were definitely delving in and they were having fun going, we love this story. We know this story well. We're enjoying telling it. This is such a fun. And then you literally see them at the moment, like when Mercutio dies and them going, oh, right. And just so we're clear, the only text I added in, they had a moment that was literally from, it was from the original play that Shakespeare used, probably plagiarised a little bit. Uh-huh. There was a scene, so I added something in there, but I didn't add any dialogue in, but you sort of saw them in their role, realising that even though they were telling the story, they had lost the story and you can't change it. And even though they knew where it was going, it was still engaging, it was still important. Even though the audience knew that this was going to end well, they were still in it and they were still invested. You know, it wasn't like, oh, well, I know how this ends, I'll leave. So that was sort of the premise of this, the art of the storytelling, the art of, and again, it goes back to the origins of storytelling. It was the same stories retold. But if it was a good storyteller, there was always something new that they added or a way of delivery. But even there were stories, if you liked them enough, you went back to them. I mean, how many of us who love books or films, like we go back and rewatch or reread the things we loved, even though we know how they end.
Oh, absolutely.
It's comfort, it's
Pride
familiar.
And Prejudice. Pride and Prejudice.
Thank you.
Hello.
Yes. So, and then the only furniture was a chair and an ottoman, which was like, that's what you sit in to tell a story. Mm. But they were everything that was needed. Mm. And Sam and Greg were the ones. They moved things, like they told the story. They moved things around. They positioned things.
So you had set pieces that you moved to change scenarios and
So for example, we sort of performed in front of the proscenium, so we used some of the stage, but mostly it was on the ground and the audience was sort of semi in the round.
So the proscenium being the
just sort of the front of a proscenium stage, but we had a lot of floor in front of that.
Yes.
So the audience were on the floor too,
so everyone was at the same level.
Correct.
Yeah.
To a lot of the action. But then for example, the balcony scene, which, side note, is actually never specified as a balcony scene. It's just become that.
Really?
But we, yeah, there's no reference in the text. It was, I did all the research at the time, but I forget. But I forget
well
which production.
Read. Yeah.
Forget which production or even, I think it was production, I don't think it was a film, where that was it, that was a director's interpretation. And it was so beautiful, like Juliet on this, because she is unattainable. He's a Montague, she's a Capulet. I love her, but I can't reach her. There's an obstacle to get to her.
It's the visual symbolism.
It's a beauty. Yeah, and it's also because, I mean, both of them are important, but, you know, the Capulets, they are wealth, they are status.
Yes.
She's high and he's, in order to get to her, it's problematic, it's difficult and it's with significant risk. So it was a great interpretational choice. And it was one of such significance that it is now referred to as the balcony scene. And almost every interpretation will have her in a balcony or some other high, you know, it will do that.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's visual,
correct.
Symbol.
Yeah. Well, and space. Space is everything. You use space. Like, and whether people realize it or not, like we interpret space. Space gives us information about relationships and power and status. So it was really simple. She was standing on the stage and he wasn't on the stage. And Sam and Greg slid the ottoman on and he jumped on the ottoman and that he got closer to her. Like it was just little things like that.
Yes.
So it was just the chair and the ottoman, that was it. But they were used for pretty much everything that was required when there was a set piece required. Because I also like using minimalism and playing around with space in interesting ways. And I won't talk in the same detail because I've talked forever about Romeo and Juliet. But with regard to space, the next Shakespeare I was really drawn to was Macbeth because we haven't really touched on this, but I've also been quite keen, and it hasn't always been intentional, but there's always been quite a strong feminism concept within a lot of my work.
Yes, and I apologise. I did want to touch on that. That is something that's been quite strong. And
well, it was a real discovery for me. Like, I grew up, not only did I not have a concept of feminism, but I was not a feminist person growing up. I was very much influenced by the world in which I lived in my society, and I had some pretty crappy attitudes, you know, not necessarily deliberately, but sort of unconsciously, this is what I think because I don't know any different. But I also am a bit ashamed to think probably took me a little bit too long of living in a broader, wiser world to sort of pick up and going, oh, you might need to do some work. You might need to do some. So, yes, so I've done a lot of work, and it was really good for me to then have theatre as a way to explore and develop that understanding. And also, I suppose, to go, well, a lot of people are still struggling with this concept. How can I, you know, because sometimes people don't like to be told, hey, this is not acceptable. You should not think this, or you shouldn't say those things. But sometimes if they go and consume art, it's a way of giving them those ideas, suggesting alternate perspectives and a shifting of, you know, priority and balance without them feeling smashed on the head. They can come to it themselves at their own pace. So, yes, I've quite enjoyed it, but also it's been sort of for myself to explore those ideas. And so I was very drawn to Macbeth because, as I've said, Shakespeare was, you know, incredibly patriarchal time, and yet Macbeth has not one but four incredibly powerful female characters, like significant, and Macbeth is very much at the mercy. I mean, he's still the title character. He's still the most important role, and the whole story is about him. But everything he does is because of the influence of these women. And for those of you aren't familiar with the story, I'm talking about his wife, Lady Macbeth, and the three witches who say to him, well, this is what you're going to do, which sets off the chain of events. That is what happens, because he then comes back to his wife and says, hey, you won't believe what these three witches told me. I'm actually going to be king. And she's like, well, the only way you'd be king is if you killed the king. He goes, yeah, I know. And she goes, so let's kill the king. And, you know, so I'm not portraying any of these four women as great, virtuous, incredible role models, but they are powerful women, and we need to be okay with that women are also powerful, and that maybe women don't use their power for good, but we also need to have more women in roles of power and influence and strength and wisdom. But that doesn't also mean they have to be perfect with it, because, my God, men are not perfect with it either. That's what equality looks like, that there's equal representation of everything.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, that's really interesting. So what I did with Macbeth is I wanted to show the magnitude, the brilliance, the power of women. And yet, regardless of all their ability, intelligence, qualification, society was still like, yeah, but we know. And it was also at the time of Julia Gillard. Now, I'm not going to get into politics. If you don't support Julia Gillard's policies, her stance or things, okay, that's, I'm not weighing in any way with regard to who she was as a politician, the values that she projected, the legislation she developed. If you disagree with that, that's fine, because that is what politics is. You are.
That's right.
My thing, though, is if you disagree with Julia Gillard, then you disagree with the policies and the stance of Julia Gillard, which, of course, lots of people did do. But unlike with male politicians, our media was riddled with, look what she's wearing, what about her partner who isn't even a husband, like the references that were made about her physical appearance, the speculation about her home status and the dynamics of her relationship. It was vile. It was disgusting. And it was
whether she had children or not.
That's, oh my God. And it was like, well, who, and if she did have children, who'd be taking care of them? Oh my God.
Does it matter?
Correct. And it's like, I'm not here saying you have to like Julia Gillard. She's great. I'm saying if you don't like her, the only relationship you have with this woman is as the Prime Minister of the country. And therefore, if you don't like her, then your discussion needs to be targeted to her decisions as a Prime Minister of the country. But because she's a woman, you feel entitled to dissect and degrade her fashion choices, her physical proportions, her lifestyle choices, her relationship and home dynamics. I'm like, it was disgusting and it was vile. And basically at its core, so much more complicated, but at its core was, we don't cope with women in leadership. We're not okay with it. And that classic thing of that, so if we're not comfortable, if we're not happy, then we don't attack the concepts, the ideas, the direction. We attack the person. We attack the character. We attack the physical layer. So what I did with Macbeth is in the story of Macbeth, there are three official power holders. You have King Duncan. Macbeth then kills him, so you have King Macbeth, and of course that sets off a whole chain of event, and then Duncan's son Malcolm comes back, and then he is king, you know, after Macbeth is killed by Macduff. So you've got three kings. So with the casting, I kept them as men, right? Because no matter what, the men do still have that significant hold over the power positions, but every other character was female. And we're, again, I didn't rewrite the script in any way, but we edited and directed and presented that they were female roles. They were absolutely female roles and female power. Like, so for example, with how we presented the three witches, because it was put in a modern context.
Yes.
So one was like a media, like a journalist, a media mogul, like very much in control of communication, power, information.
Wow.
Someone was worked in security and in law enforcement.
This is the witch, one of the witches, number two, yep.
And the first, I think, was like a CEO, like was a power leader, et cetera. So these women are in position of power. And again, like people, they were able to influence, but and they had enormous power and enormous sway as people of power do. But even with that capability, that intelligence, that qualification, society was never going to quite let them be in that top seat, which would then fuel them going, this is not a comment on women, this is a comment on power, which would fuel them going, all right, well, we may not get the seat, but we will get the control. And they had the control. And Lady Macbeth was the same. She's like, well, they'll never let me be king, but let me. So
behind every great man.
Correct. That was the tagline.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. Oh. But then the poster was Macbeth and then all of the women behind him because everyone played a role. Oh, that was the other thing we developed, you know, I don't know how you know Macbeth, but there's the role of the porter who just has one very funny scene because he's been drinking the night before and then when they all arrive in the castle the next day, he's absolutely hungover and has a whole lot of funny lines. And it is one of those scenes that it is almost only funny if you have a really solid knowledge of Elizabethan context and language. It doesn't really translate. So that was one thing we did bring in a dramaturg and he rewrote it and reworkshopped it with the actor playing the porter. But then I basically any servant, any sergeant, any assistant I got rid of and the porter. So the porter was Macbeth's right-hand man, except it was a female, who had a broom and symbolically referencing that there was cleaning up and, you know, the people that are invisible in the background but are fully aware of everything all of the time. And she was brilliant. She was a fantastic actress. And so she went throughout this role that was completely insignificant and invisible and yet aware of everything.
Who is the actress?
Ellen Kiley.
Okay.
Yeah.
Shout out
to Ellen Kiley. Anyway, so and the staging was set. I said I was going to do this briefly. You can edit the heck out of this.
No, this is like guys, part five.
I have ADHD. Did that come up? But the setting
I love you, Emma.
Was, thank you so much.
You're doing, I am feeling very privileged being in this room and hearing all these stories. Okay, but keep going.
No, like I said, promise I'm nearly done. But, yeah, so what I did was I put the audience in four sections and because I was fortunate I had a huge.
Was it in the round?
No, in the same principle. I'm trying to remember when I came. This is the thing. I just have all these ideas and I couldn't even tell you when they happen. But Macbeth is all about decisions, like these moments of decisions. And that's the thing. Macbeth does have reservations. And Lady Macbeth, while she pushes and go, you will go kill Duncan.
Yeah.
And while he's the one who kills Duncan, he comes back and he was supposed to leave the knives with the guards to implicate them. And she's and I think kill them and she's like, oh God, so she calls him infirm of purpose, which is one of my greatest insults. and goes and she does that herself. You know, so while he's still the one who kills, she also then goes and kills and implicates, oh God, you ridiculous man, you spineless, like just let's just do it. But then like most people, you know, you're in that moment, you make those decisions, but then Lady Macbeth goes quietly but progressively insane and the famous line, out, out, damn, but she cannot get the blood off her hands. She believes there's real blood there because there was blood. Yeah. But, of course, it's you know, this idea, this memory of this is what you did and now you have to live with that. And so, of course, she unravels and dies with the intensity of that, like the implications of that.
Yes.
And so it's all about decisions and the decisions we make. And I also implemented things because I created an interesting shift with Duncan that he attempted to sexually assault the porter. And the porter
you brought that in.
Yes. And you see that moment of the porter going, you could see that moment of the porter knowing that no one would believe her. Like it's a king and she gets away luckily because he's drunk. But then there's a whole process of her because I put lots of movement. There was movement to song and stuff. We had this beautiful, we call them the movement. And they came in and they were a bit of a Greek chorus. They had some unison passages and things that they did. But they also had some movement pieces that served as sort of like a Greek chorus that would link one movement, one episode to another, and they came in and you saw the physical manifestation of her internal conflict and what it was she actually just escaped and what it could have been and who he was it's all about decisions and these moments when you could do this but you do that. And while you might do that completely understandably in that moment with everything around you, but then afterwards how does that sit with you and does that then make you make, as with Macbeth, he just then kept making a series of very, very bad decisions. So what I did was I had the audience in four sections. So therefore, by default, the negative space, the stage space, was a crossroads. So think about traverse theatre, but then there was also the aisles coming off the other side as well. And that was, it made it a very challenging thing to direct, but it also made it really interesting. And things like the final showdown between Macduff and Macbeth, where Macduff is victorious and Macbeth dies. It starts at the beginning and it traverses the entire, and then Macbeth dies at the end. So you sort of see that pathway, that development, that progression that, you know, only one of them can reach the end. Yeah, but that idea of people standing at that crossroads and going, well, what am I going to do now?
Mm.
What is this the right decision? Or even making a decision and going off in a direction and then afterwards going, that was the wrong direction. How do I retrace those steps? Is that a possibility for me? Or have I gone too far? Like all of those kinds of ideas. It was exploring that concept.
It's so rich though. You know, you might go, you know, someone might go see a piece of theatre. I might see a piece of theatre. Someone might have walked from one part of the stage to the next. And then, but it's the amount of work and thought behind the scenes, the process behind that to get that person, that actor, to be from one side to the other.
Yeah.
It's rich.
There's a lot of choreography, and choreography doesn't have to mean dance, a lot of movement choreography and decisions behind and pacing. I'm really big on pacing. Like that was too, no, like it's three steps, it's stop, it's and then now we move again. And
yeah. But all of the story that you're bringing into that now, like why they're here and it's layered. Layered.
I've never had an issue with the ideas. And one idea begets another idea and begets another idea. Sometimes I perhaps need to be a bit tighter and go, well, cool, they're your ideas, but then you need to edit things back so that it's not overwhelming and it's not too much information. It's not laborious for cast and crew and even audience. So there was a lot of refinement that I was doing as I moved through the work and I did get a lot better at a lot of those things, but there's still honing to do. But so the ideas were sound and people engaged with the ideas, people loved the ideas, but I still had some tweaks with the execution. Sure. As I said, I would be excited about the ideas and I'd share them in the documentation stuff. I'm going, well, actually, if something like a crossroads, for example, maybe some audience members would completely miss that, but I think an enormous number of people are going, oh, look at this. This is a bit different. It's a crossroads. Oh, decisions. Oh, you know, conflict. Oh, what are they going to do? You know, but then also imagine what else they might have. Well, I mean, a lot of them still would have. Like, yeah, you need to be able to walk away from the work.
Yeah.
You need to be able to walk away from the work and go, well, I've done what I wanted to do and this is why I wanted to do it. And there are core elements of that that you can share and express and discuss, but large parts of it you also need to be able to step away and go, well, it doesn't belong to me anymore. It belongs to the audience. It belongs to the consumer. It belongs to the patron.
But you have released something into the world and whatever that your intentions were, it's the main intention and there are lots of thoughts and processes behind it, we can only see what that is in that final outcome. Not that that, you know, is what it's all about, but the understanding that there is such a backlog of thought and process and time and pain and
sacrifice
to go into that moment.
The other thing too that I think is important and can be very difficult as an artist, a practitioner, a creative, in my case as a director, but this is applicable to so many other disciplines and art forms, is you have this idea, you have this message, you have this conversation you want to spark, but you have to be very aware and okay that not only can you not control that conversation, but you're also not going to be privy to it. The best conversations, the best impacts of your work are going to be on the train on the way home or three nights. Someone's going to go to their parents and go, I saw this play. And it could even be, I mean, and I was very open to and honestly quite excited about that someone might go, oh, I saw this play, Macbeth. It was shit. Why was it shit? Well, but even if they didn't like it, the reasons they didn't like it would still, someone would go, oh, but that sounds interesting. Yeah, it was, but they didn't do it well. Or I didn't like this actor. But it would still be a conversation that would, and they would say, oh, she intended to do this. Like there was this, there was this political commentary within it. Oh, but then that might start a political conversation that, like I said, with book club, it's not even about the book anymore, but it is about the concepts, about the ideas. It's about where those ideas currently sit in the society in which we live. So if I've done the job well, obviously you want people to enjoy your work. You want them to be engaged. Like, that's just sort of your foremost role. If you're making people sit quietly, pay money, engage in theatre, it should be engaging. It may not be enjoyable if it's confronting stuff, but it should be engaging because that's your responsibility to them. If they are bored, if they're frustrated, then you're not doing your job. But engagement doesn't have to be enjoyable. They don't have to appreciate it. They don't have to love it. They don't have to get what you wanted them to get. But then even if that is where they're at, that will be a conversation. Mm. They will go and they will have that conversation, and you have sparked that conversation. If it's a conversation they wouldn't otherwise have had, if it sparks them, so I would, you know, pepper my programs with different quotes and references to things, and who's to say someone didn't even pick up, they go, oh, who's that person? And go look at that. Terry Pratchett, who's my favourite author, has a fabulous spiel about storytelling in his book, Witches Abroad. So I put that in my Romeo and Juliet program. Perhaps excessive, I don't know. Like, it was relevant, but it was also indulgent. But who's to say someone did look at that and go, oh, who's that guy? If one person started reading Terry Pratchett because that quote, oh, my God, I'd be so happy. So who's to say what those conversations entailed? Even if they weren't positive about the work, were they productive about the ideas?
Yeah.
Did they spark engagement? Did they spark conflict? Did they spark active connection in, oh, well, actually this is a problem in our world. Oh, this is a thing that's happening. This is an opinion I hadn't bothered to form, and I probably should have an opinion on this issue.
Yeah.
And then that gets fueled and sort of supported by the spaces in which they're in. So as a director and a creator of art of any medium, if you've done a good job, whether they like the work or not, they should talk about it. The conversation should be rich, robust, and in depth, but you will never get to hear them.
Mm.
Look, some, like if engagement, social media and things like that, sure. But honestly, in most cases, you probably want to avoid that anyhow because those conversations between people in the same.
Yes.
You don't get to be part of it. You don't get to control it, and you probably don't even get to hear it. And you have to just, which is why you have to just be so okay with the work.
Yeah.
You have to be okay with the work so that you can step away and go, well, I can stand by it.
Yeah.
And that's hard. And I'm not saying that is something you easily do or even can do, but that's the goal.
It's a really, 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 really good point that you've made though, because it is that moment of when you have released something, you do want to be privy to everything.
Mm.
You want to know.
Yeah. But it's, what do you think? What do you think? What are people saying? What's going on?
And it's like releasing, release, let go, let it go.
It's not about me anymore.
You've done it. You did all that work.
Mm.
Release it. Your job's done. Yeah.
And see, I struggle with that, you know, that because I've got a life where I get to pretty much control everything I do because of, as I've explained before. And I mean, I explicitly teach to my students, you know, as a director, you are in charge.
Mm.
You are the decision maker and the authority up until bump in, up until the moment where you move from rehearsal into, even though there's still dress runs and tech runs and all those things, once you move into the theatre, which isn't, you know, once you move into the theatre, the director, you're done.
Mm.
The stage manager is now in charge and the director steps back.
Mm.
And the director may not even be in the space. I mean, if you're talking in the professional sphere, the director may now have another gig. They've got, you know, the stage manager is now running the show. The director's job should be done.
Yes.
And I'm someone who would struggle, like I would be struggling to not be directing right up until opening night, like opening night, if we're going, oh, can I just give you some notes, which is on one hand adorable and like you have the great rapport with your actors and things like that. But on the other hand, I look back, you know, like you would look back and go, no, you shouldn't have done that. You need to not do that. And also, while it wasn't actually the case, it projects a message of, well, you don't trust the actors. It's like there's a reason you cast them. There's a reason you did put them in this place. Like, let them do their jobs. They are good at their jobs. Leave them alone. Like, you did what you did. But it also, it isn't.
Let them explore.
Not a dictatorship. Like, the director, the core element there is they are the decision maker. Like, if any decision has to be made, well, it comes back to the director because people have to trust that if a decision is going to be made, the director's going to make it so that guidance is clear. You want that. But that making a decision doesn't mean that it's an autonomous decision with absolutely no input.
Mm.
Like, you have actors that you have cast for a reason. They get input. And I've had some actors come and go, you know, actually this – can I offer a suggestion? I'd like to workshop. We'll workshop stuff together. Like it has to be a communal effort. There has to be significant input and influence by every other person who is invested and contributing to this show. But again, if you do have a bit of an impasse or we like this, we like that, well, what are we going to do? Then the director's the one who's going to go, well, then this is the decision we make. This is what happens. But you have to be able to gift those people with, no, this is your autonomy. This is your influence and you get to own that. So that was something I struggled with earlier. But
so insightful now.
Oh, so insightful now.
But I do have one other question as well as, will you direct again?
I plan to, but interestingly, and I think I was a bit sort of not grief-stricken is far too dramatic and inaccurate, but I suppose concerned is in the part, as I said, I could not switch the ideas off. And I would be in the middle of directing Romeo and Juliet and planning the next one, planning Lysistrata. Oh my God, I've got this and writing these ideas. Like, you'd have one foot in each project, like all these things.
Wow. When that starts,
With when I had sort of, I've had that rough time and there's a few other bits and pieces that have happened. I've sort of had a bit of a stripping back of self and really having to rebuild and regain and like I'm in a real state of limbo at the moment. And for the majority of that time, I mean, it's one thing to go, yes, you've got these ideas, but you need to be strong to go, I'm not doing them. I'm not doing them until I can do them well, until I can do them with complete focus.
Yeah.
But most of the time at the moment, I don't have any ideas. I do, like, that's not true, but I don't now necessarily think that's a bad thing.
No.
I actually think it's not the worst thing and it's allowing me time to regroup. But, yes, I suspect that I will direct again. I would like to direct again. That is absolutely the intention, but there isn't the drive yet.
Or the right project.
That's correct. So I think it's kind of nice and exciting that at some point I'll stumble across something and I'll go, oh, that's it, yes. And then the ideas will come. But you said something really early on about where the ideas come from. It may even be in the intro to the podcast itself. But when I sort of get a bit closed in and a bit overwhelmed, a bit tired, and, of course, during COVID, you couldn't even go to the theatre. Mm. So as much as I adore the theatre and I think the theatre is my lifeblood in so many ways, I wasn't going much to the theatre. And then in the last couple of years, 2 or 3 years, I've started going back to the theatre, still not enough, but going back to the theatre, going back to good theatre. And while I am engaged in and loving the theatre I see, I think I'd forgotten that if I'm watching good theatre, it's like fireworks up there. Like every other line, every moment, a particular way someone moves or a set choice or a colour aesthetic will spark something.
And while Emma was saying spark something up there, she's moving her hands above her head. So it's...
Yeah, in my brain.
In your brain has sparked.
Yeah. It sparked something. Like in my brain, it's like imagine fireworks up there. Like I suppose neurons firing, I think, is the, you know, what literally is happening. And I couldn't turn the ideas off. But it's kind of a closed experience at the time as opposed to me then going home and grabbing everything and going, right, let's start playing. No. But it was just so exciting because I was like, oh, there you are. Yeah. Oh, she's still there. But I can't not do that. Mm. I can't. Like good theatre, it will just be this constant, which is beautiful and, again, like such gratitude and admiration for the creators of that theatre because it's not everything some theatre you see and for me personally it's not great. Doesn't mean it's bad theatre. It's just not good theatre for me.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I might sort of sit there and go, okay, yeah, not much of – but sometimes even then I'll go, oh, I would have done that differently. Oh, that's an idea for a completely different work.
Mm.
But, yeah, it's –
So there is that contrast. It's like even though something might not work or you might not like it or you might like it or you might not, and then all of a sudden it's like there are things that spark out of that.
Yeah, and then you work out what is just a cool idea and what is something like, oh, hold on to that, write that down.
Mm.
Even if it's something you come back to in 3 years' time. Again, like putting myself in Katie's position. Mm. She watched documentaries. She wrote down notes. She did some research and goes, oh, that's going to be relevant. Or she'd have lots of conversation with people going, oh, did you know about, let me tell you the story of.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't even her first instinct when I came to her, probably my fault because I kind of tried to keep it open but probably closed in a bit. I'll maybe look in these kind of parameters, maybe think about this sort of stuff.
Sure.
But she still came back and said, no, this is a thing I've been thinking about for 4 or 5 years. What do you think?
Now,
again, that was the time for her to bring that idea up.
Well, again, let's think about the slow burn.
Mm.
You know, you don't have to be outputting every year, every minute, you know, it doesn't have to be a final outcome. It can just be every day, a simple sketch or a doodle, you know, like.
Mm. Well, we're all creators. Everyone is a creator. Everyone is being creative all of the time. And I think that's that's sad too, that I think some people see themselves as not creative. And I'm like, you are. You're creating art all the time. You are contributing to an artistic society. Yeah. You are telling stories. Yes. Whether you are telling, relaying, creating. I read a lovely book years ago, and the book's like got so many other layers to this. A lot of people wouldn't be familiar with the Australian writer Leanne Moriarty, because she wrote Big Little Lies and Nine Perfect Strangers, which now have really hit some big Hollywood projects. But one of her earliest works is Three Wishes, which is just beautiful. It's about triplets. Mm. And interspersed, almost like a Greek chorus, interspersed between the actual chapters of the three women's stories, that is the trajectory that you follow, there's a little introduction that says we all take part in stories that other people tell and we don't even know about it. And in between all these key chapters is just these little sections in italics, and it's just like these nameless people, just these snippets of conversations or relaying of events going, oh, darling, I was out doing the shops today and you wouldn't believe it. I saw this lovely couple and they were struggling and they were exhausted, but they had these three delightful girls, maybe about 6 years old, and they were bickering. And it's basically, so while the story of the triplets is them as adults, all between, it's like, but throughout their lives, because they were triplets, and that isn't something you see very often, the little conversations that people went home and had, or the observations at the time going, will you look at those three women, what's going on? And it's just that sort of idea of you're also in other people's stories. You might have just come in and said something hilarious after something you've done at work, or gone, oh, my God, let me tell you about my morning. And the way you've told the story, or the self-deprecation but also ownership of, oh, well, let me tell you about the idiot thing I did today. And then it may be so beautiful that that person listens to it, enjoys it, celebrates it with you, but goes home to their partner and go, oh, my God, let me tell you what Jason did. Yeah. Like you are part of so many other people's stories. You contribute to everybody's patchwork and experience of the human existence. You may bake a cake. You may make your child's bed. You may choose an outfit. We are creative all of the time, and we've got to put more value and worth on the creativity that we all have, and how you could also develop, well, if you can put together a beautiful outfit, then what else could you? Yes, that's art. Yes, you are artistic. Yes, you have an eye and a vision and a skill. So, yeah, you know what? You've been thinking about doing creative writing, but you didn't want, oh, my God, go. You want to do a life drawing class? Go there. Like, what are you going to do, a cooking class? You want to learn a language? Go. Like, never underestimate your ability to create, because it's almost the only thing you can be assured of that every human being can do.
Mic drop.
Boom.
We can.
Yeah.
We will.
We are creators. That's what we do.
Emma Sproul, I'm going to wrap this up.
I think you should. I think it's best that you do.
I love you. Thank you.
I love you too.
So much. You are amazing.
Oh, stop.
So intelligent, so well spoken, such an incredible storyteller. Just the stories you tell. I mean, I could sit here for hours. I have been sitting here for hours, literally.
I want credit for the fact that the cats didn't come up at all, other than.
I know, we're uninterrupted for all this time. This is incredible.
Mm. I meant me literally bringing them up.
yeah,
telling the stories of what, you know.
Yeah, we didn't even have cat stories. That will be next. That'll be next episode.
That's a whole other podcast.
That is a bonus episode. But thank you so much. I just feel so privileged to be able to hear your stories. And it's been a really long time that I've been able to hear you speak so eloquently about the practice that you have, the education that you're imparting onto other people, and just what you're sharing right now. Mm. It's so rich and so rich. And, yeah, I am a little bit gobsmacked and speechless because
please stop. But can I just interrupt you and not negate anything you've just said, because it's absolutely beautiful. And honestly, the timing's probably quite delicious. But simultaneously, make sure you're very aware, and I'm sure your listeners are, how lucky they are to have someone like you at the helm of a podcast of this nature, and how flattered I am to be considered a voice that you would want to share in this space. And you are an exceptional artist of pretty much any discipline that exists. And I feel Laura is such a significant part of my own artistic history and the work that I have developed and the understanding of myself as an artist. So if there are any subsequent conversations, I would love to maybe tap into that a bit more about who Laura is as an artist and how that's benefited, enriched me as an artist.
Oh.
And yeah, so thank you so much for this time, for this space, for this acknowledgement that I, yes, I don't know.
It is an acknowledgement. Yeah. And thank you for acknowledging me too. That's really beautiful. Oh, my goodness. That's, oh, my gosh.
That's nothing compared to what you deserve. And yes.
Look, the aim of the podcast is to make sure voices, creative voices are heard and we hear processes and that we all can create. Mm. And in fact, you know, I feel really spoiled to be in the same room as you because again, you know, isolation is big and it's really important now that we reconnect with one another.
Yes.
And to be able to use the podcast as an excellent excuse to
yes.
bring joy not only to my life but to others is great. So we will revisit each other again. Don't worry, this is not the last conversation. You probably need to start your own podcast too, mate. I reckon you're
would anyone get a word in? Like,
it's, I think it's solo.
I'll just be like, I'll get the letters I've written people. I'm just, okay, dear Laura, and I'll just read out the letter I've written to you. And,
Auntie M. Dear Auntie M.
Dear Auntie M.
Yeah. Well, okay. Right. Well, I'm signing off and thank you so much.
No, thank you. It's been an absolute delight and a privilege.
Thank you. Hey, listeners, we hope you're enjoying the Creative Rumble podcast.
If you're loving the content, why not share the podcast with someone who could use some creative inspiration?
We'd also love to hear from you. Drop us a note via our website or Instagram. Your feedback and stories make this podcast even better.
And if you want to support us further, get online to our website and click on the Buy Us a Coffee link. Your donation keeps the Creative Rumble alive.
You can find all the links in the show notes. Thank you for being a part of our creative community.
Until next time, keep rumbling.